This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte.
The Lake Area United Way is changing its focus and has in the last year or so from just the previous years where the United Way has basically allocated money to agencies in the region to take care of the issues. They focused in particular starting in last year on what are called working poor families. And we have with us Lisa Daugherty, who's the president and CEO of the Lake Area United Way, to talk about it. Lisa, thank you for joining us in the program today.
Thanks for having me, Chris. I appreciate it.
Take, if you will, some time to tell us a little bit first here about what, I guess, the definition of working poor families are and what this past year, the 2018 efforts the Lake Area United Way has had to try to find the families and to find the ways to help them the most.
Absolutely. So Chris, United Way actually has an acronym for working poor called ALICE. It stands for Asset Limited, Income Constrained, Employed. So these are folks that are working really hard, sometimes multiple jobs in our community, but for a variety of reasons, probably most common, they're not necessarily in a livable wage that allows them to afford what we consider to be very basic necessities. And when those families are struggling day to day, you know, they're making decisions every day, like, for example, you know, do I put gas in the car so I can get to work, or do I fill this prescription that I need? Do I take my child to the doctor, or do I pay the utility bill? I mean, you know, these families are making these choices every single day. And in Lake County, we've got almost one in four families that fall into that category of ALICE, or as you say, the working poor. Mm-hmm. These are families above and beyond those. We've got about a 15% level of poverty throughout Lake County. So these are families in addition to those in poverty. We went through a pretty intense, you know, we did a lot of due diligence around landing on that subject, but we knew that we needed to go back out and talk to those families. So that's what we spent, you know, the better part of last year doing, was trying to understand those barriers that ALICE families are facing and potentially identify strategies that we can invest in. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to, you know, focus first on what we heard from families.
Right.
And of course, you know, we spoke to community leaders, you know, we spoke to different mayors, organizations that are in the community helping these families, and all of that information supported what we heard from the families. But most importantly, there were six emerging themes that came out of the many conversations that we had with ALICE families. And what we heard is that, you know, number one, because they're ALICE, because they're working, they don't have access to a safety net. So when folks are in poverty, as an example, they have a lot of public assistance that they're eligible for. But as ALICE, or the working poor, they're not eligible for that support. So if they don't have family or their church, as an example, to count on to support them, they are literally on their own, and in some cases more vulnerable than folks that are in poverty and have that safety net. The other thing we heard is that these families don't have access to enough access to food, particularly healthy food. And again, with these families working, they can't just go to a food bank or a food pantry, because a lot of times those pantry hours, you know, aren't necessarily accommodating to working families. You know, they're not open on the weekends or evening hours when working families need to access them. Of course, health care. You would expect health care to be an issue. You know, the cost of that and insurance and a lot of the jobs that they're in, they don't have, you know, good coverage that's affordable. Housing. There's not enough housing stock in Lake County that doesn't require more than 30% of your household income. And when families are spending, you know, too much on housing, it you know, makes them very vulnerable and one crisis away from, you know, losing everything or falling into poverty, being homeless. Mm-hmm. And then the other two areas are ultimately where we landed as a United Way to focus, and that was on families not having enough access to affordable, quality child care so that they can work, and of course, a pathway to better paying jobs. You know, these families that we met, they're smart, they're resilient. What they, you know, juggle and manage in a day is amazing, but they are not networked. They don't know where the job opportunities are, and they might need just a little bit of, you know, skill training to get to the next best opportunity. But they can't step away from their job to go for training, even that's free. Ivy Tech offers a lot of training that is, you know, paid for by the state. But they can't access that because they need to earn their income to pay their bills.
On the subject of child care, in talking with the agencies and other organizations, how much did you all figure on average it probably costs for child care here in Lake County for a mother or for a mother and a husband?
Yeah, broad average is around the $10,000 mark.
Wow.
So, of course, it varies, right? I mean, that's a mortgage.
Yeah.
And it's unfortunate that parents are faced with that decision, because if your child is participating in that affordable, in that quality child care where there's a good curriculum, those kids are prepared for kindergarten. And when they are prepared, their chances of success throughout their entire education are far better than if they don't have. You know, a lot of kids, families have to rely on, you know, grandma or an aunt or a neighbor. And thank God they have that, that access to even that so they can work. But the reality is grandma doesn't know how to, in most cases, if you have a retired teacher grandma, you know, then you might be very lucky.
Have somebody who's qualified to be able to do the right kind of preschool child care that you need to help get the youngster ready for school.
Yes, but most families are not that fortunate. Mm-hmm. And the kids don't have, you know, that curriculum for those couple of critical years prior to kindergarten to get them ready.
We're talking with Lisa Daugherty, who's the president and CEO of the Lake Area United Way. The United Way has been focusing last year and is continuing going into 2019 to focus in on some of the major issues in Northwest Indiana and Lake County in particular. And we're dealing with family members, I guess the common title, although it's not the official title, I suppose, is the working poor, family members who are working, but they still, even in the job or jobs, multiple jobs they have, still aren't making enough money. Just barely to make ends meet and to try to get ahead to plan for a better future. We talked about child care, and that's one of the focus areas, you say, is what the United Way is going to continue on into 2019. The other is dealing with employment and with something more than just, I guess, a workable wage. What would a workable wage here in Lake County be that's something that you strive for?
So just as an example, because, of course, that wage varies with family size. But if you take a two-parent household with an infant and a young child, that family, in order to afford very basic necessities, needs to make around $52,000 a year. I mean, that is what that household has to bring in order to afford. That, no luxury items there, just your basics, like a reliable car that gets you to work, a house that doesn't, you know, that's in a safe neighborhood that doesn't, you know, take your entire household income, you know, food on the table for everybody in the family.
And that's the area that's why people have to work more than one job or put things together even or been part of the part-time workforce that we have now these days that don't have a full-time job and can pick up a part-time job to add on to it. They have to put together two or three or even more part-time jobs to get by.
Correct. And, you know, what we've learned in our process is that there are, in fact, many very good jobs in the community, but the families don't necessarily know or they aren't necessarily ready today to step into that job. They might need just a little bit of training. We actually have a jobs work group that meets the first Tuesday. It's comprised of folks representing organizations like Methodist Hospitals, because of course healthcare is a major employer, Horseshoe Casino. There are many jobs that are currently available that pay a decent wage. We've got Ivy Tech at the table because, of course, they provide a lot of training. There's a lot of state, you know, funding that's available for training. But again, families don't know about it. So Work One is also at the table. Goodwill Industries, you know, all of these organizations either have jobs or they offer training that can help families, you know, get to that better paying job. And what Lake Area brings to the table, Lake Area United Way, is that we have a coalition of organizations throughout the county that are serving families. So it will be adding us to the equation with that grassroots effort to get families connected to these opportunities is going to help these families thrive and, of course, you know, ultimately the community.
Now, are any of these organizations already working or starting to work with the Lake Area United Way going into 2019 to help come up with a strong strategy to help these family members that need the help, that need the re-education or additional education to be able to get that good-paying job to get out of the so-called working poor status?
You bet. All those organizations that I mentioned and more have been meeting regularly. We have been bringing in organizations that provide some sort of support or training opportunities to talk about what's available to families. We've had a panel of employers that came in and spoke to this strategy group. We call it a work group. About, you know, what the barriers are for them as an employer and what they see for families. And today, Ivy Tech is taking us through a facilitated process called Simplex, which is a problem-solving tool that's going to help us take everything that we've gathered in the last, you know, 6 months and identify those strategies that, you know, I like to say low-hanging fruit, that Lake Area United Way can invest in 2019.
Now, do you think, besides all of these goals that you're trying to reach here, in particular with this particular problem that the United Way is focusing on, is there anything else you can try and fit into the plan for the rest of or most of 2019?
Well, we know that, we tried to take a focus on root causes. And so, you know, I mentioned those other emerging themes that we heard from families. Mm-hmm. We know that if we focus on helping families access childcare, which is going to help them be employable, that they're going to enter the job force right away, get people connected to education and better paying jobs, that's going to resolve those other issues. They won't need a safety net. They'll be able to afford more of the housing inventory that's in the community. Healthcare is going to come along with those jobs, or at least put them in a position to better afford it. So, the focus on those two issues alone is a big job and is going to require a number of resources. But, you know, we're super excited about the fact that now our campaign, so when we go into an employer now and we talk to the employees about where we're focused, they get it. They relate to it. If they don't have that hurdle themselves, they have somebody in their family or in their circle, you know, community, their church, they understand these barriers. And every time somebody steps up and gives of, you know, their time, talent, you know, or resources, they're going to help more families get access to childcare and jobs. We know this is a longer-term focus for us. We also have grant opportunities now that we can pursue, major grant opportunities that we can bring into the community.
Is this an opportunity for funding that you didn't have before necessarily by just offering up grants to help agencies along the way?
You bet. Nobody wanted to invest any longer in giving United Way money just to simply pass on to other organizations. They started donating to them directly, which, you know, makes sense, that which is why we've, you know, revisited our model, because that role as an impact or as a middleman doesn't have the impact that it used to. So now we are taking a lead in the community as the backbone organization around, you know, this issue. And, it's, you know, some of the funders that have been at the table with us from the beginning, like ArcelorMittal as an example, they've funded our new work in a significant way. They're excited because they don't see other organizations really focused in on these families. And they understand that if we can, you know, create pathways and lift, you know, give these families a hand up, that the entire community is going to benefit.
Well, they probably recognize, too, that maybe there's a possibility that some of these people helped along the way may be future ArcelorMittal employees or employees of any major industry in the region.
You've got it. It's exactly that. And I will tell you that, you know, the families that I've met, I mentioned earlier, they're strong, you know, they're smart, they're resilient, they're hardworking. These are the people that employers want to hire.
Well, Lisa, it's been a busy 2018, and it looks like busy 2019 ahead,
yeah,
to be
great.
Sure, too. Thank you for talking with us about it.
Thank you, Chris.
Lisa Daugherty is the president and CEO of the Lake Area United Way.
We're revisiting conversations from the past year for Green Fleet Radio. Today, here's your host, Lori Cagle, in for Carl Lissick, from a conversation on November 28th, 2018.
Well, thank you for that introduction. This is Lori Cagle in for Carl Lissick. Today, our guest is Mark Smith, Technology Integration Program Manager for the U.S. Department of Energy's Vehicle Technologies Office. Mark, welcome to the show.
Good morning, Lori. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, we're thrilled to have you. Obviously, we work awfully closely with you in our office, but can you please tell our listeners, what is the Department of Energy's Clean Cities Program?
Sure. The Clean Cities Program was actually founded 25 years ago. In fact, this is actually this year, 2018, marks the 25th anniversary of the program. Was founded really as a way to help find alternative sources to foreign petroleum. The program really works closely to try to help get alternative fuels and other advanced technology vehicles into the fleet market and into the transportation market for consumers to help reduce our reliance on petroleum.
Absolutely. Now, sustainable transportation helps reduce emissions and improve air quality, we know, but it also helps with our nation's energy security. Can you explain how it does that?
Sure. Great question. So what we're really trying to do is promote the choices that are available here in the United States. The good news is that we have lessened our dependence on foreign oil, and foreign oil imports are down, but we still use a lot of oil that comes in from offshore. However, we have a lot of great domestic sources that are available to us in the forms of natural gas, for example. We see a lot of activity in natural gas with heavy-duty vehicles, electrification of light, and now inroads being made into medium heavy-duty vehicles as well. So we have these domestic sources we can use that really help with us promote our own energy security and our own resiliency.
Great. And can you share some of the success stories from the Clean Cities program for our listeners?
There are quite a few out there, as you can imagine, after being around for 25 years. I think one of the biggest things, though, is first of all, the coalitions have played a major role in helping to advance the work we do here with the Clean Cities Program, and more importantly, as part of DOE's Vehicle Technologies Office. So having nearly 100 Clean Cities coalitions around the country that serve about 80% of the population really help us to have these boots on the ground experts who can help both fleets and consumers understand some of the technologies that are out there and some of the choices that are available, so we can really help them make an informed decision. But having said that, Clean Cities coalitions have played an important part in helping to get more than 800,000 alternative fuel vehicles on the road since the founding of the program.
Wow.
And as of today, there are about 23,000 alternative refueling stations out there. That includes electric vehicle charging stations. And the Clean Cities coalitions have also played a big role in helping to get that infrastructure deployed, which is really needed. You know, oftentimes it's easy to get into the chicken and egg discussion about if you have the vehicles, you have the station, but you need the stations for the vehicles.
Right.
And I guess the adage is you need both the chickens and the eggs on the table at the same time, and the coalitions have played a big role in helping to make that happen.
Absolutely. Well, those are some impressive numbers. You're listening to Green Fleet Radio on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Lori Cagle in for Carl Lissick with Mark Smith, Technology Integration Program Manager for the U.S. Department of Energy's Vehicle Technologies Office. Mark, what are some of the changes you've seen in advanced vehicle technologies over the years?
Looking back at the history of the program over 25 years, when the program was started, the alternative fuels were limited to pretty much natural gas, biofuels, propane. There really wasn't a lot happening in electric vehicles. In fact, you could probably say even up till probably about 5 to 8 years ago was when we really start to see more availability of electric vehicles. So we're seeing electrification really take a big hold right now in transportation, and I think you're going to see more of that. You know, companies now are using electric buses, for example, in transit agencies. We're seeing some companies that are making Class 8 tractors that are going to be electrified. So I think the electrification part is very important. But we're also looking at this new movement in transportation where we're seeing a lot of, I guess you could call them disruptive transportation modes coming out there, and disruptive in the form of being new and different. So you look at car sharing and ride sharing. You look at the TNCs, the transit network companies, which are the Ubers and Lyfts of the world.
Sure.
So we're seeing the whole mobility of whole landscape mobility really changing a lot. And one of the things we're doing at DOE is really trying to get our arms around of what are the energy implications of these new technologies. If we're going to have automated vehicles, are we going to be driving more or driving less?
Right.
You might argue that you might be spending less time in the car, but that car, if it's an automated vehicle, could be making a lot more trips, right? It could be
sure.
taking me to work and then going home and getting the car and taking my wife to work and then going home and taking the kids to school. So you could actually have an increase in miles traveled, and thus you could have an increase in energy use. So at the DOE, we're really trying to get our arms around, as everybody is in both the public and private sector, of what this new mobility landscape looks like and what are the energy implications going to be. But I think it's a very exciting time.
Yes.
Because it's a technology, if you will, or technologies that are happening very quickly. And so I think we're all trying to catch up to it as quick as we can.
Well, I'm glad that there's good folks like you in D.C. who are working on all of these issues and keeping us moving forward. How can our listeners learn more about Clean Cities, Mark?
Sure. So the best way is probably to go right to our Clean Cities website, which is cleancities.energy.gov, which will tell you some more about the program, as well as provide a listing of all the Clean Cities coalitions and coordinators nationwide.
Great. And that will do it for today's edition of Green Fleet Radio. Thank you again to Mark Smith, Technology Integration Program Manager for the U.S. Department of Energy's Vehicle Technologies Office. Green Fleet Radio airs 3 times each Wednesday on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm your host, Lori Cagle, in for Carl Lissick. Thanks for joining us, and remember, it's never too late to begin your environmental legacy.
Green Fleet Radio is made possible by South Shore Clean Cities. You can hear Green Fleet Radio on Wednesdays here on Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, and the podcast of Green Fleet Radio on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Just search for WLPR. Well, state lawmakers are back at work tomorrow, so we talk with Lieutenant Governor Suzanne Crouch about her thoughts on the session ahead at the close of a conversation we had with her back on November 21st. In 2019, there's, of course, another General Assembly session, and you get to sit in on the Indiana Senate activities as the President of the Senate. Are there any special things that you are aware of that may come up in either chamber, the House or the Senate, in this upcoming session?
Let me first share, Chris, mm-hmm. that as president of the Senate, I was a former state representative for 8 years, and I just always like to share with people that as president of the Senate, it's so gratifying to finally be in charge of the Senate.
it's probably in many respects, it's like herding cats, you know. That's always a phrase that it's very difficult to handle a group of people like that when you've got all these individuals in one room, though. But a lot of good things can happen, I know, if everybody works together. And, of course, we know this next General Assembly session is another budget session, so I'm sure that's going to be top priority, is to try to get the priorities together for spending and yet stay within the realm of a balanced budget.
Absolutely. To stay within the realm of a balanced budget without raising taxes on hardworking Hoosier families. But In addition, they'll be looking at trying to fully fund the budget with revenues that aren't as robust as maybe they've been in past years. So it'll be a challenge, but one certainly that the Indiana General Assembly will be up to. And we will be looking at education funding with K-12 and higher education takes up over half of our budget. I think the last number I saw was those two areas combined take up about over 65% of the total general fund budget. And then when you put in Medicaid, you tack on another 14%. So all the rest will be money that will be looking to be allocated over the other very causes and agencies that serve Indiana and serve Hoosiers. So it'll be a challenging year, but one, as I said, that the governor and the Indiana General Assembly will be up to. And I'm confident that at the end of the day, we will have a balanced budget and we will be able to continue to work on taking Indiana to the next level.
Lieutenant Governor Crouch, thank you very much for what you've talked about today, knowing that, that the General Assembly has certainly plenty of work to do when they come back into session in January. And we appreciate you spending some of your time to talk with us today about it.
Thank you, Chris, and keep up the good work.
We'll continue the conversation about Hoosier politics in the upcoming General Assembly session in just a moment. This is Originally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte, and let's get a review of 2018 and the big Indiana political stories. And for that, we're turning to Brian Howie, the creator and publisher of Howie Politics Indiana. And as always, Brian, thank you for spending time with us today.
Yeah, Happy New Year.
Thank you.
Happy New Year to all the folks in the region.
We'll pass the word on to you, and thank you very much for that. We know that on Howie Politics Indiana, you spent a few minutes putting together an analysis here. Give us your take on some of the big things, and there were several of them, I know, in the world of Hoosier politics in this past year.
Well, the thing that really jumps out at me is the decline of the Indiana Democratic Party. The headline on that, obviously, is Senator Donnelly losing to Mike Braun, the U.S. Senate seat. So, you know, out of 11 congressional seats, two in the Senate, nine in the House, you've got, you know, Pete Viscolosky and Andre Carson, and that's it. Indiana Democrats hold none of the statehouse constitutional offices. They only hold 41 out of the 150 General Assembly seats. Well, they have about half the mayor's races. The statistic that just I found jarring was that 89% of county commissioners in the 92 counties are Republican now, and 80% of courthouse offices are Republican. Now, Lake County is a little bit different, so is Marion County. But boy, once you get out of those two counties, it is we are a very red, red, red state. We're turning into a one-party state. So that's one thing that just really jumped out at me this year.
I know that, and even in one of your more recent columns here, you talk about municipal politics, and in particular, with everybody's keeping, of course, a close eye on Hammond Mayor Tom McDermott Jr. But he seems to be that he said this also publicly before, that he's preferring to seek re-election rather than look for higher public office. And do you think, in your opinion, based on all of this that has happened in the 2018 election to the Indiana Democratic Party, that was probably a wise decision?
Yeah, I mean, if you don't have the local infrastructure, I talked to Robin Winston, the former Democratic chairman, who, you know, he was very instrumental in getting Governor Bannon re-elected back in 2000. And one of the things he told me was that when Frank went out on the road, they would always have, you know, at least one locally elected official meet with him, whether it was the mayor of Gary or Elkhart or county commissioner or something like that. There are so many counties now in the state where there's no Democratic elected officials anymore. The party's really let that slide. And so, yeah, Mayor McDermott told me yesterday that he is planning to run for re-election. And so who's going to run for governor in 2020? We have a popular governor. There's a new public opinion strategies poll for the Indiana Realtors that has Governor Holcomb's approval rating at 65%. That's pretty high. But here's the real difference, which is you look back at past years, 2 years out, there's always somebody, you know, whether it was an Evan Bayh or John Gregg, couple times, that by this stage in the game, they were positioning. They were making the rounds. They were saying they're going to get in the race, and there's nobody. Now, Tom McDermott was one of the people I was really keeping an eye on because I thought if he got into the race, he'd be very credible. Christina Hale, the former state rep, who's a lieutenant governor nominee, she's another one I'm looking at, and Greg, those seem to be the three, but there's really nobody out there surfacing saying, yeah, I'm about ready to get into this race. That's really different, and that tells me that the Indiana Democratic Party is really running on fumes at this point.
I suppose that would mean, obviously, that Mayor McDermott, although he was, of course, he'd mentioned publicly that he wasn't going to take his focus off the city of Hammond, that it was a pretty wise decision to make because he may have felt that he was not going to necessarily get all the support that he might have needed from the state organization.
Well, you know, I don't even know what's left of the state organization. You've got the Democratic chairman, John Zodi, coming back, and there doesn't seem to be any opposition mounting there. But, you know, you look at the Indiana Democratic Center Committee, that was dominated with Hillary Clinton supporters back in 2015, 2016, and yet Bernie Sanders wins the Indiana primary with 53% of the vote. One of the things Robin Winston mentioned to me when I talked to him after the election in November was, you know, there are a lot of Indiana Democratic Central Committee members still there that were there when he was state chairman back in the, 20, 25 years ago. And so the party just hasn't really brought in new people. You didn't have that Sanders element representative on the Central Committee. And now they've just been routed. They're pretty much consigned to Lake County, St. Joe, the college towns, Bloomington, Muncie, Lafayette, and Indianapolis. And that's about it. I mean, there's only like one or two Democratic legislators down in southern Indiana. Whereas back in the day, you know, a lot of those courthouses and everything along the Wabash and Ohio Rivers were Democratic. They might vote for Reagan or Bush for president, but they would then vote for a Democratic legislator and a Democratic county clerk, and they've all turned Republican now. So, again, this is a party that we're turning into a one-party state.
We're talking with Brian Howie, who's the creator and publisher of Howie Politics Indiana, taking a look at political news in the Hoosier State in 2018. And besides, of course, the state of the Indiana Democratic Party, you mentioned, too, about the fact there was a knockdown, drag-out fight, in, I guess, some respects, for the Senate seat that it turned out to be Mike Braun's, but also behind it an awful lot of money. Millions, literally millions and millions of dollars, I guess, spent by both sides on this campaign.
2 years ago, I predicted that we were going to see a $100 million U.S. Senate race, and that was predicated on the fact that you had the U.S. Supreme Court, you know, Citizens United decision back in 2010, and then 2012 between Dick Lugar, Richard Murdoch, and Joe Donnelly, $51 million was spent on that race. 2 years later, or 4 years later, in the 2016 race that Todd Young won, that came to $75 million, and now this time, when you added it all up, $110 million of that amount, $69 million was outside money, or what Senator Donnelly said in his farewell speech on the Senate floor: dark money. We really don't know where it comes from. You can get into the various super PAC filings and everything. It's very hard to tell, you know, who's really funding these super PACs, where that money's coming from, and yet they're determining who wins. I'm not sure, you know, Mike Braun could have won that race. He might have, because he's a self-funder. He put $11 million of his own money into the race, but let's say he wasn't a millionaire. You can make a case that maybe the dark money really determine who's going to control that Senate seat. I'm not sure that's a good thing for democracy.
Mm-hmm. Well, Brian, let's jump to tomorrow, even as close as tomorrow, as the Indiana General Assembly gets another budget writing session underway here. What are your thoughts about some of the topics that are going to come up, and maybe even some clue as to what some of the bills will be introduced as well?
Yeah, the Lieutenant Governor Crouch, I think she's spot on. The Holcomb administration is going to pump close to $300 million into the Department of Child Services after you know, the criticism from Judge Bonaventura about a year ago. They're taking that very seriously. You know, higher education, I think she said it's, what, 14% of the budget.
Mm-hmm.
The governor's committed to Medicaid expansion. And so there's not going to be a lot of excess funds available. So even though we're in this robust economy, you're not going to see a lot of, you know, new money for a lot of other projects that you know, are going to be proposed. And it really makes you wonder, you know, what happens when we get into the next recession, when things get tight. And, of course, the governor, I think he wants to keep about $1.8 billion in reserve so that we don't have to raise taxes if we get into another recession. The other thing that I'm looking at is the hate crime legislation. We've had a spate of intolerance across the state, and the one that seemed to really be the tipping point was the swastika spray painted on the synagogue in Carmel. Governor Holcomb's told me that he's going to be very vocal in pushing their state crime legislation, and I take him at his word. I think he's going to do whatever he can. Indiana is one of five states that doesn't have such legislation on the book. The other thing I'm interested in is, you know, Michigan just legalized recreational marijuana. Governor Pritzker over in Illinois is basically saying it's not when, it's how. So I think Illinois is probably going to go recreational here by the end of the year. And then in Ohio, you will have a referendum next November. And so, you know, Indiana likely is going to be that middle finger. We're going to be surrounded by states that have recreational or at least medicinal marijuana, and yet the governor doesn't seem to need the revenue, and doesn't seem, unless the Food and Drug Administration, you know, changes its stance. And right now, marijuana is a Schedule I drug. I don't see him changing his position on that point. So you're going to see some legislation on that front. I just don't think it's going to get much traction this year.
Let's jump back real quickly here to the issue about bias or hate crimes, whichever you wish to call it. We've found out recently that the guy who's running things in the Indiana Senate, Rod Bray, has already said that he is going to put any proposals that come in over into one of his committees that he takes care of. And we know that State Senator Mike Wahatchek, who's a Republican from Michiana Shores, is going to offer up a bill, co-sponsored by his colleague Ron Alting from Lafayette, to dealing with the legalities of bias crimes. Do you think that maybe this is going to make it more difficult for Mike's bill to make it through?
I'm not sure. In the past, if a bill got assigned a rule, Senate rules, it was kind of a death sentence. Rod Bray, you know, got into this office. I know a lot of people are impressed with his skills, and I think what he wants to do is to make sure that he can control that process. The fact that you've got two Republicans that are going to be authoring this legislation tells me that there may be some open minds. There are going to be some, particularly on the conservative right, who are against it. And then, of course, we've heard historically Speaker Bosma, he believes that current Indiana code allows judges to take into account the nature of the crime and to increase penalties. So they've long maintained that you know, judges have that latitude already. The fact that, you know, that jumps out at you is, you know, 45 other states and the district have some kind of hate crime legislation and we don't. And then when you get into kind of a bidding war like we just saw on the Amazon thing, you know, that's kind of one of those window dressing kind of things. So, if I had to put a money bet on it, I would guess that we're going to see something get on Governor Holcomb's desk. And again, he's promised to use his bully pulpit to try to push it. And again, this is a governor with a 65% approval rating without an obvious challenger in the wings. And he's got two Republican supermajorities. I think he's one of the more powerful governors that we've had with all those attributes and concentrations. Power.
And we know that the governor's already said that he is going to be making some definite comments about the issues that he is holding dear this legislative session when he gets with everybody in the same room for the State of the State message coming up later in the month here. And I know that you're going to be keeping a close ear and eye on that as well, too. And we really do appreciate you spending time with us, Brian Howie, talking about these issues, and hope to have you back on. Hopefully that you'll have time, besides keeping an eye on the lawmakers, to be able to join us and talk about these issues again, too.
Anytime. Love to.
Thank you very much. One of Northwest Indiana's newest state legislators has a big task ahead of him. Besides learning the ropes as a lawmaker, he's channeling through the Indiana House a measure that he hopes will get some support. It's to help the town of Griffith deal with poor relief expenses. I talked with State Representative Chris Chung as he was getting ready to head to Indianapolis. One of the things I know that you're going to concentrate on, among a lot of things, besides getting accustomed to being at the State House for your first legislative session, is to be able to take on the wishes of your constituents. And, of course, one of them, a big group of them, for that matter, is the town of Griffith. Tell us how the town officials asked you to get involved in the issues that have come up here since they can't seem to find a suitable township to be able to join here now.
Yeah, we were just talking together about some of the issues that had come up. I mean, it was a really interesting thing that happened in September of 2018 when the town did vote in a special election with really high turnout to ultimately decide with 98% of the vote to move their town out of a certain township. So it was a really interesting thing politically and election-wise that occurred. And when we had been in discussions with Griffith about how to proceed, we were thinking that they would be accepted by either North or St. John Township ultimately in the end. What happened was that those townships, I think, felt maybe a little too under pressure to get something done by the end of the year, and they ultimately decided against taking action in the near future. So that means that for the foreseeable future, Griffith is going to have to look for a legislative solution, which is how we kind of got to talking and seeing as how I represent a good portion of the town of Griffith.
How did this discussion that you may have had with Rick Reifa, who's the president of the town board and the other members of the town council, tried to figure out what would be the best way to approach this? I guess they just realized that their first major problem that they were dealing with Calumet Township was what they were sending in revenue to the township and was not getting covered and coming back for poor relief expenses.
That's right. Yeah, that was the main impetus for starting the special election and the movement to ultimately secede from Calumet Township. What I did was I just try to make sure that I'm on I'm transparent and accessible when it comes to the town and local government levels. I reached out to other town council members as well in my other towns to discuss some upcoming legislative issues that they may be concerned about, or to ask what are their priorities. I want us to all be on the same page regardless of party. And one thing I'm doing is that I'm on the local government committee as the ranking minority member. So I think we're going to see some interesting, really important solutions for local government be handled.
Do you think you got on that committee not only a chance to get your feet wet, so to speak, in committee work, but also because the fact that that you represent a district that basically has a lot of major county operations in a way, I guess, because you have, three towns basically within your district? There are portions of at least three.
Yeah. I have Dyer, Schererville, and then portions of St. John and Griffith. So it's quite a number of towns and a lot of interesting functions there that we have to make sure that we're on the same page with the state.
Now, on this issue of trying to come up with a way to help the town of Griffith with their poor relief operations, be able to fund the poor relief operations without having to deal with Calumet Township, did you have to confer with any other state lawmakers, some veterans that maybe have gone through the same type of thing or be familiar with it, to get things together for this measure that'll come up?
So I did talk with the chairman of the local government committee, Denny Zent, who's from a different part of Indiana. The place is escaping me, right? I think it's Angola, Indiana.
That'd be northeast. It's not terribly far from here, but it's on the other side here.
Yeah. So we did talk a little bit about what's going to be coming up, and we're going to continue those discussions. What I really want to do is make sure that we're, again, super transparent in this process of bill drafting. There are no little, loopholes or anything. It's a really clean bill, I think, that we have drafted, and a really clean, common sense, good government solution that will help the town of Griffith.
Is this going to be one of the measures that get introduced first off as the session gets underway?
We're going to be looking at the pathway, whether it's introducing the bill outright or introducing it as an amendment, because the legislature has this funny rule called the bill pending rule, which means that if you introduce something as a bill, you're not allowed to introduce it or talk about it as an amendment. So you have to really pick and choose your battles carefully, which how you want to introduce it.
You think maybe that's a good way to get started, I guess, even if you don't do it yourself, introduce it yourself as the sponsor, that if you're part of the process, a good way to learn things too, I would imagine.
Yeah, absolutely. I would agree.
Okay. Now, you gave us a little indication here of what you're hoping to do on this particular bill. What if you can tell us now, what will this look like, at least at introduction, when it comes in and goes into the hopper?
So right now, we've been talking about with the town council since, I should back up a little bit, mm-hmm. with the Department of Local Government Finance, the DLGF, which is the entity downstate that oversees kind of all of the municipal finance level government functions in the state of Indiana throughout the towns. And one thing that we talked about was what would the new government potentially look like? And the best option that we decided on was modeling it after Indianapolis's county council or city county council UNIGOV option. Mm-hmm. So what ultimately we would do is just transfer that option here, translate it to our needs, and the town council and the executive of the town council president, and the town council itself would be acting as the trustee and board of the township, respectively. We think that's a really common sense solution that doesn't add an unnecessary layer of government that will make the business running the town really smooth. And one thing we've talked about with those folks is that folding in some of the township functions at the town council level is a really doable thing from what we understand from it. Having the boundaries the same will make it a lot easier and reduce administrative redundancies. And it's just a good common sense bill, I think. So that's our option.
DLGF seemed to feel that because there's been this push because of the measures that have been passed in the past to try to reduce the amount of state government, in particular township government, that this was a better option to go with rather than having to be forced into creating your own little township in the town of Griffith and just be one more little plug in the hole, so to speak.
So the option we have now is actually creating its own township government. It would just be the same boundaries as the town of Griffith. There have been larger talks with the State Chamber of Commerce and other groups out there who are looking at abolishing township government altogether, which is kind of a really bold move that I don't know if we're ready for at the entire state level. If anything, I think it should be left up to local control, kind of a local decision whether or not the township you find is really necessary. I like to use the example that I live in St. John Township, and even though I appreciate and admire the people who run the township government, I wouldn't really notice if it were gone tomorrow. Unlike North Township, which does provide a lot of services with Wicker Park and with the Dial-A-Ride, it's extremely visible in the community, and a lot of people are big fans of that service and paying into it and making sure it's well run. And Frank Mervan has done a fantastic job as trustee, and all of his experience has proven.
State Representative Chris Chung, as he's getting ready to head to Indianapolis, talking about one of the measures that he is going to help work on as the General Assembly session gets underway. Lakeshore Public Radio's friend and fur, Ollie, joins us in the studio now to answer your pet's questions on Ask Ollie. The pet questions voiced by woman-human Victoria Voller, and Ollie's responses voiced by man-human Tom Maloney. Ask Ollie is supported by the Humane Society of Northwest Indiana.
Now let's take a look at part two of Ollie's Darwin Award nominees for 2018. Again, if you have a favorite, send us an email, ollie@lakeshorepublicmedia.org. Up next, a Fresno, California man accidentally set his parents' house on fire while attempting to eradicate a spider infestation with a blowtorch. He was trying to remove black widows and their webs from the brick exterior of his home when the propane flames shot through a crack and ignited flammable material, setting the whole house in flames. All brick veneers have cracks, but not all have spiders. Up next, Jesse, a pet parrot stranded on a roof, greeted a British firefighter by berating him with a burst of F-words. The owner told the firefighter to reclimb the ladder and say, "I love you," to the macaw. The firefighter reluctantly climbed the ladder again to rescue Jesse and said those three little words. Jesse told him to f*** and the rescue attempt abruptly came to an end. The bird's owner should have taught Jesse to be politically correct when trying to play the system. Oh well, the female parrot eventually flew home on her own accord, and the firefighter is currently in therapy. Up next, from Malaysia. Unemployed and looking for some extra money, 35-year-old Zaim Kalis Kosnan passed away in a shocking case of death by snake. Kosnan apparently saw a 12-foot python on the side of the road while riding his motorcycle. According to his sister, Kosnan returned home and told her that he intended to capture the snake and sell it. He then left with a pair of gloves and a sickle. Later, Kosnan was found dead on the side of the road near his motorcycle, the snake still wrapped around his body. Upon examination, police discovered he died via strangulation. Officials theorized that the snake began to constrict him while he was driving, leading to a fall from his motorcycle. The police believe Kosnan was holding the snake by its head while transporting it home, allowing the reptile to curl around his body in self-defense. Really, everyone knows snakes hate motorcycles. Up next, Minnesota firefighters had to use the jaws of life to free a noisy black bear that got its head wedged in a metal can used to hold dairy cream. A conservation officer spent 2 hours trying to pull the 10-gallon can off the bear's head. Exasperated, he called the local firefighters, no, not the one from England, and they used the jaws of life to cut the can off. The conservation officer is nominated for trying to wrestle with a bear that had a 10-gallon metal can stuck on its head. The bear still has claws, and they're quite scary. Up next, a spectacular, colorful duck native to East Asia has mysteriously appeared in Manhattan's Central Park. The male mandarin duck was first spotted in the Central Park pond where he drew large crowds. The human nominated for this award is the one who leaked this story to social media. I just wonder how long that duck lasted in Central Park. Up next, an Ohio man has become an internet celebrity after another driver filmed him cruising down the highway with a cow in the back seat of his pickup truck poking its head out the window. Annie the cow is 18 months old and weighs 800 pounds and often rides with her owner, Corey Morris. Her favorite destination is McDonald's for ice cream. When Morris is asked why she rides in the back seat of his truck, he responds, "Where else would I put her?" We are nominating Morris because instead of paying for ice cream at McDonald's, he could have chosen Culver's, where they cheerfully give the driver free pup cups or cow buckets or whatever. And finally, a bison calf had to be euthanized after a Quebec man loaded it into the back of his SUV. Humans who move baby animals from the wild need to rethink that. Many animal moms leave their babies alone while they hunt for food, and that does not mean they need to be loaded into the back seat of a car. Don't mess with them, warns a professional wildlife manager. Locally, if you have an issue with wildlife like Karen and Dick Hutter had a few weeks ago with a loon, a diving aquatic bird, they found trapped on the sands of their Ogden Dunes beach, contact the Humane Indiana Wildlife in Valparaiso for advice. We are nominating that man who was trying to save the world one bison calf at a time. It's a bad idea. No bueno. Well, those are the nominations for the Ask Ali Darwin Awards for 2018. Again, if you have a favorite, let us know. Give us an email, ali@lakeshorepublicmedia.org. And remember, love is a four-legged word.
And if you have a question for your friend and for Ali, you can also send it to ali@lakeshorepublicmedia.org. Ask Ali is supported by the Humane Society of Northwest Indiana. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for being with us. Back with you tomorrow. It's going to be Reporters Roundtable Thursday.